Now, for tonight, the title of the talk tonight is Vipassana is Insight. What is a vipassana? The term vipassana is usually translated into English as insight, and it comes from the root passati, to see. And we speak of vipassana primarily as being clear seeing. This clear seeing is important because in our daily lives, often we don't see clearly. In fact, sometimes we barely even know what is happening in a day. Sometimes we just go through our routines on automatic pilot, blinded by our patterns and our habits. And it's as though we're even unaware of the life around us. When we come on a retreat, we're invited to give clear seeing the foremost attention. What did you see today? What did you clearly know? How did you behold your experience? How did you relate to life? I picked up my Buddhist dictionary as I was writing this talk and looked up vipassana to see, well, how does the Buddhist dictionary define this term? And it said, vipassana is the intuitive light flashing forth and exposing the truth of impermanence, the suffering, and the impersonal and insubstantial nature of all corporeal and mental phenomena of existence. It is the insight wisdom that is the decisive liberating factor in Buddhism. It's kind of a mouthful, but dictionary definitions always are. The popular notion or idea is that vipassana is about watching the breath, or we might expand it to watching sensations arise and pass, or to letting go of thoughts. But I think it's important to understand that vipassana is not just a meditation technique. It means insight. It means clear seeing. It's fundamentally about how we engage, how we know, how we engage with life. We realize this insight through processes and of mindfulness and investigation. And what we investigate are called the three characteristics of existence, or the three marks of phenomena. In Pali, these are called anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca refers to the impermanence or inconstancy of things. Impermanence refers to the way things begin and end, arise and pass, are born and die. Nothing lasts forever. A breath comes and goes. A life is born and ends. The inconstancy aspect refers to the changing nature of things. Things age and decay. They increase and they decrease. They intensify and they diminish. So when we explore anicca, we explore both the beginnings and endings, the stopping and starting aspect, and also the change of increasing and decreasing. We can work with that very simply with the breath, or with any sensation. Notice when it starts and notice when it stops. Oh, anicca, impermanence. Notice if it increases, notice if it decreases. Anicca, impermanence. So we move from a specific characteristic of, say, pressure, to its general characteristic of anicca, when we see that that pressure increases, decreases, stops, and starts. So we're refining the investigation, not just to know that there is pressure, but how that pressure is changing. Dukkha refers to the unsatisfactoriness, the suffering, the stress, or the unreliability of conditioned phenomena. This pinpoints a basic unsatisfactoriness to all conditioned things, simply because nothing can be relied upon to provide lasting happiness for us. They're not dependable as a basis for our happiness. People experience this quality of dukkha not only through explicit stress, anguish, and suffering, kind of that like heart-wrenching, agonizing experience. That's kind of like the first few days of a retreat. But we also experience in that subtle sense of just always needing a little bit more, never really being satisfied, never quite being content. Or as one of my friends says, there's always room for improvement. That in itself describes dukkha. So please don't think of dukkha always as that awful suffering, but it refers to just this simple fact that nothing will satisfy us in this conditioned world. Anatta is translated as not self. And Sandhya spoke of this last night. This refers to the fact that when we look, we just cannot find anywhere in our experience a fixed, reliable, self-existing entity. There is no one behind our experience who is experiencing it. We can't like find a little Shaila somewhere in there who's giving this talk. Like, well, where is she? What is she? What is that? There's just nothing particular that we can grasp a hold of and say, this is a stable definition of who I am. There's just basically no static, fixed essence to whom my life is happening that we can call self. So we look into our experience and we wonder, is there some kind of intrinsic being lurking behind our face, inside our hearts, or perhaps in the elbow? Who knows? Is there anyone who is claiming this experience as mine? So we look into this tendency to assume that there's somebody back there or inside here or some ultimate witness to our experience, some soul that is sort of collecting our experience. And we look and we find we can't find something that we could really call a self. And yet, life is happening. Experience is being known. It's just not happening to a reified, solid, self-existing entity. It's happening. It's being known in a process. So the insight into anatta, into not self, isn't a demand that we, like, destroy the ego. Not at all. It simply occurs when we're not taking life personally. Vipassana meditation techniques are designed to give rise to these three specific insights, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. It's as though they shine the spotlight onto these characteristics of existence. There are lots of different ways to practice vipassana. There are dozens and dozens of vipassana techniques out there. Those of you that have practiced meditation in Thailand, in Burma, in India, in Sri Lanka, in other countries, will probably have been exposed to several different vipassana methods. And you might even wonder, well, which one should you do? Tovana invites people who teach very different vipassana styles. But the theme from every vipassana technique that I have ever learned is to realize and to look into anicca, dukkha, and anatta. We focus on these insights because our freedom is revealed when we simply stop misperceiving our experience, when we stop assuming that experience is lasting, could be the basis for our happiness, or really refers to me. You may be familiar with a very popular story that, or illustration, metaphor that's used in many spiritual teachings of a story of a man who is walking along a path and in the forest in the jungle, and suddenly stops because he sees a coiled form on the path and thinks it's a snake. Gets quite scared and is frozen in fear. But as he's standing there, he's looking and looking and looking. And then he realizes, oh, that's not a snake after all. That's a rope. And the fear dissipates. And it's a beautiful example of misperceiving experience, believing experience to be something other than it is. The problem wasn't solved by the snake becoming a rope. We didn't have to transform the external situation. The problem was solved by clear seeing. But too often we misperceive the experience and then we react emotionally to the misperception, winding ourselves up in a turmoil of conflict, uncertainty, doubt, not knowing what to do, panic, anxiety, fear, anger, distress. And yet it's regarding a misperception. Kabir said, when the eyes and the ears are opened, even the leaves on the trees teach like pages from the scriptures. So what is insight? Do you think it's going to be a very exciting experience? Maybe there'll be fireworks. Maybe rainbows will come forth from your ears. Maybe there'll be little sparkly lights, or the person sitting behind you might notice a halo or an aura. Or that even though I've never seen anybody actually float, you'll float until you hit your head on the ceiling. Sometimes we think something spectacular is going to happen, but I don't think that is necessarily the case. Very often we just simply see clearly. It's as simple as that. We see things as they're actually occurring, rather than the way we think they should be occurring, or the way we wish they were occurring, or the way our views and opinions say things should be. We just see them as they are occurring. How simple, but how easy. How much ease there is, how much non-conflict there is in clearly perceiving events as they are. There's a tale of Mullah Nasruddin. And Mullah Nasruddin was walking down a village street when some thugs, some kind of street gang, a group of kids were throwing stones at him. And he says, "Don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. I'll tell you something that you'll really like to hear." And they said, "All right, but no philosophy." And he starts to tell them that he heard that there was going to be a free banquet that the emir was giving to anybody who comes. And there were going to be delicacies of this sort and that sort. And the cooks and the chefs have been preparing food for days. He heard about them collecting milk from this part and from herbs from this other place. And then the musicians were exquisite. He had heard some of their practice sessions, and he started to really warm to his theme. And then he realized that the kids had all run off in the direction of the palace. And so Mullah Nasruddin tucked up his robes and ran after them, thinking, "I'd better go and see. It could be true after all." Too often we subscribe reality to our desires. And we lose touch with what's true in the moment because we're just lost in the stories that we've woven of our own rather creative minds. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, sensing, thinking, is our mental and physical process clear or distorted? Do we see clearly? What's actually happening? What's happening now? These three characteristics are emphasized again and again and again. And each and every time we look into them, it can be as though we are seeing them for the first time. You've all experienced these characteristics. You've all experienced change, right? Morning changes into evening. Weather changes. We eat the food, it goes through a process, and then it comes out in the toilet. It's like a change. There's a process here. We age. None of you are feeling exactly the same thing you were feeling a week ago. We experience change, but have we drawn the insight of impermanence from that change? We experience unsatisfactoriness. Well, I know that because I've been in groups and individual interviews with many of you. And there's plenty of dukkha to go around here. And if you feel like you have no idea what suffering or dukkha is or unsatisfactoriness, just sit for 4 or 5 hours without moving. And no problem. You'll have an insight into dukkha, guaranteed. What about this not-self, this aspect that is empty of inherent existence? Well, just consider, are you who you were yesterday? Is the one who is the hearing, the consciousness of hearing, the same as the consciousness of smelling, as the consciousness of thinking? Can we find somebody behind our experience who is the taster of the taste, the thinker of the thought, the sensor of the sensation? Or is it simply sensation being known, taste being known, thought being known? Really look into this. Don't believe me. Just don't take it as a proposition that you have to believe. But look into it. See if you can find something that you call self. Does it have shape? Does it have color? Does it have a location? Does it have any attributes? Is it an it? Is it not an it? What is this that we were calling self? We find ourselves exploring and discovering that each place where the mind lands and wonders, is this it? We say, no, that's not it. And we explore again and again a process of momentary contraction, momentary grasping, momentary illusion. Perhaps there's really no one, no thing to whom this life is happening, and it's merely a beautiful process that's being known, that's unfolding moment by moment in clear awareness. Smelling is being known. Touching is being known. Emotions are being known. So we've all had experience of these three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. But how do we extract the insight from the experience? How do we squeeze the honey out of the experience? How do we let them mature and affect us? How do we experience our life of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking in a way that is liberating, that is free? When we enjoy a gathering of friends, do we know that it will disperse? When we receive a gift of clothing, do we know that it will get stained or get torn or wear out? When we look at, I don't know what your equivalent is here, but say you're in Australia or the south of, say you're in Australia, when you look at a beautiful, cool river, and you go there for a holiday, although it's an awful long flight, isn't it? Do you know that the crocodile is in there? Do you know that there is dukkha in the thing that we desire, the thing that we look to for our pleasure? If you invest in the stock market and you are delighted when it goes up, do you really know that it inevitably is going to go down? Anything that goes up, goes down. when we are praised, do we know that there's also blame? The truth of anicca, dukkha, and anatta can be discerned in just about every experience that we have, if we want to look for it. It's one thing, though, to hear a talk about these characteristics, or to hear a talk about suffering and release, about freedom and the end of suffering. But what about our release? What about the realization of liberation? Our own direct intuitive insight into things. What about that? Insight transforms our experience. It isn't just a cool little thing that you'll get on a retreat that you can kind of put in your wallet and show to friends. It isn't a containable that way. And in fact, if it is reduced to a snapshot like a memory, or a memory like a snapshot, it's not really an insight. An insight transforms our experience. It's the spotlight that puts our experience into such a clear view that it's not just an intellectual understanding. It's not just a cool experience. It's not just something that happens to us that's just like something we heard in the Dharma talk, or just like something we read in the discourses of the Buddha. But a real insight transforms the fundamental way that we encounter our experience. Because when we perceive anicca, we don't cling. And when we perceive dukkha, we don't cling. And when we perceive anatta, we do not cling. When we know these characteristics in a moment of contact, we don't cling. Our minds can open to this clear seeing quite unexpectedly. We may not necessarily understand exactly what it is. We may not even be able to say, now I am having an experience of the insight into anicca. We might just realize that we're relating to something in a way that is not grasping it, that sees its flow, of the flow of experience. We may not even know that it's happening in any particular way. We might just sense that we're touched, that we're moved, that somehow in our perception, something has shifted, something has changed. And for a brief moment, we've stepped outside of our conditioned patterns, our habitual ways of seeing things. We're experiencing beyond the framework that our usual habits demand of experience, which puts self-reference in, which demands that our experience be a basis for happiness, and which wants to keep the things that we like and make go away the things that we don't like. Insight shifts our point of view beyond the known. And because of this, language often doesn't describe it very well. We may gain a new insight about mundane things. We might gain personal insights about our psychological patterns, how certain thoughts might trigger certain emotions, and see just what our inner tendencies are, what our reactions are to things. And we can learn a lot about ourselves. So there is a place for personal insight in this practice. Sometimes we're sitting in silence and just sitting peaceful, quiet, happy. And then as we get up, we realize how creative the mind is. It was quiet, but now it has a new insight, and some problem that we were working on just is naturally, obviously solved for us. We see it so clearly. A vision might arise. A creative act, a clarity that can occur. And sometimes we just find that we don't really know what the insight is that happened, but somehow mysteriously our lives are oriented more and more to something that we deeply value. In that alignment with the truth of things, we can awaken to a realization that is unconditioned, that's inexpressible, that's immeasurable. The three specific insights of insight into anicca, dukkha, and anatta are cultivated in Buddhist practice because they prevent clinging. And when clinging ceases, suffering ceases. Just now, without thinking about the past and remembering what you were doing before, without thinking about the future and wondering what will come next, and without analyzing anything that's happening in the present moment, just now, is there any problem? Is there any trouble? Are you stressed? Are you bound? Is anything lacking right now? Problems are only in how we conceive of things, and we make our experience problematic when we misperceive things. That misperception, classically, is to conceive the impermanent to be permanent, to interpret what is unreliable as a satisfactory basis for our happiness, or to view what is both impermanent and unreliable as being self. What are you experiencing now? Your genuine experience. Whatever it may be, are you okay with it? Do you accept it? Just now, not the last second and not the next second, just now, open to that. When we experience now without the burden of past or the burden of future, we usually find no problem at all. Realize this experience of presence. And again, presence, moment by moment, simply opening to what is and knowing it as it is occurring. In the middle length discourses of the Buddha, there's a discourse titled A Single Excellent Night. And I'm quite fond of this. There's a four verse teaching in this discourse, which I'm very, very fond of. And I have most of my students at home set it to memory because it's all, you know, it's only 16 lines, four verses of 4 lines each. And as they read the discourse, there's these little dialogues between monks and deities and the Buddha and various people. There's actually 4 discourses in a row that repeat the same verse. And basically they're saying, do you remember that discourse on the single excellent night? Oh, no, I forgot that discourse. Could you remember it? Can you say, oh, no, I forgot it. Do you remember the detailed explanation of it? Oh, no, I forgot it. And so basically they encourage each other. You must remember this. This is fundamental to the holy life. This is an important discourse to remember. So there's so much encouragement embedded in the dialogues that surround this discourse to memorize it that I just thought, well, let's memorize it. And it's very joyful. Michaela's kindly translated it into Hebrew, and we'll post it on the bulletin board. So if you feel so inspired, I hope you'll consider memorizing it, either in English or in Hebrew, whatever you're comfortable with. A single excellent night. He says, let me not revive the past or on the future build my hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let me see each presently arisen state. Let me know that and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, by day, by night, it is she, the peaceful sage has said, who has spent a single excellent night. It's a nice teaching, isn't it? Shall I say it again? Oh, I can't do that. Let me not revive the past or on the future build my hopes, for the past has been left behind and the future has not been reached. Instead, with insight, let me see each presently arisen state. Let me know it and be sure of it, invincibly, unshakably. Today the effort must be made. Tomorrow death may come. Who knows? No bargain with mortality can keep him and his hordes away. But one who dwells thus ardently, relentlessly, by day, by night, it is he, the peaceful sage has said, who has spent a single excellent. I think this little discourse describes how to live a life that is prone to insight, that is inclined to insight, that is conducive to insight. Meditative techniques and practices create the conditions that make the mind ripe for insight, but we don't make insight happen. Each time we come back to present moment awareness, each time we let go of the entrancement of the thoughts and we just wake up to what's actually happening, develops this bare attention that reveals what's actually happening now. More direct than our concepts about what's happening, more direct than what we believe should be happening. We observe our experience as it changes. It might be as simple as feeling the rising of the abdomen and feeling all the changing sensations on that simple movement. We observe our experience as it passes. We notice the beginnings. We notice the endings. This process of noticing beginnings and endings, increasing, decreasing, even if we're just working with the nuances of the breath, this leads to the insight into anicca. If we're mindful of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience, this feeling tone, and how the mind relates to feeling, this leads to the insight into dukkha. And if we're mindful of how we relate to experience through this arising of I, this selfing that Sandhya spoke of last night, this process of identification, and we investigate just how this contraction of I arises in an otherwise rather peaceful moment. This reveals the insight into anatta. As we practice, we learn to rest in our moment-to-moment experience in seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, and thinking. It doesn't matter what is happening in our senses. If we can rest in our momentary experience as it is unfolding, before we're lost in a train of thought about it, then we simply are with what is, and we can experience very clearly, clear seeing of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. A student once described a proliferation of thought which was so petty, it was an excellent example. I'm sure you've all had variations of proliferations of thought. Proliferations of associations of this thought leads to this thought leads to this thought leads to this thought. When we're lost in these thoughts, we're not perceiving anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So I wanted to just talk a little bit about this thinking, because chances are, even though we've been in retreat for a few days, there's still a little thinking going on. As long as we have these minds, they tend to proliferate thought. So as we develop concentration, that diminishes a bit. The length of the time that we are involved in the thought decreases. You know, you may have been lost for 20 minutes when you first came, and now only 5 minutes. And some of you are working very keenly with the breath, and you might find that, oh, at one point you were lost for, a few breaths and then could come back. But now you're only lost for one breath. And then some of you might notice that you're not even lost for a half of a breath, but the thought itself just arises and passes like little bleeps. And then you come back and collect. So you don't quite lose even a whole breath or even a whole in-breath or a out-breath, but you know that the mind is still thinking. It's just not attaching between thoughts. So there's lots of different ways of working with thought as our practice deepens and our mind gets more and more collected. But it's worth considering just the dangers of allowing the associations to unfold unchecked without stopping them. And my student this described very simply one day. She was at work and she lost her hair clip, you know, one of these little clips. So I don't know, it broke or something, or she lost it. And immediately she thought that I better go buy a new one. And so she started to wait for when her break was going to come and she could run out to the drugstore to buy a new clip. And she felt really annoyed that she had to leave work just to go buy this hair clip and then to go shopping. And she started to think of other things that she needed to shop for and wondered if she could do them at the same time. And that started her thinking of other thoughts. But then she realized that, then she started thinking about, this is so dumb, now I'm having to miss work on top of it. I'm so stupid to have lost this hair clip. How could I have lose it? Now I have to spend more money, and my job doesn't pay very well. I don't ever have enough money. What am I going to do if I can't pay the rent at the end of the month? You know, this job doesn't have much room for growth in it. They promised me a promotion, and it's never going to happen. I better get a new job. And so on her break, instead of going to buy a hair clip, she sat in the break room reading the want ads in the newspaper and circling alternative jobs. She was getting more and more upset, more and more depressed. She felt really trapped in that job. She had to get out, and she was about to go in and give her resignation. And then she realized, I lost my hair clip. Now, we can get very depressed and upset when we let our minds circle around rather than simply respond to a very simple need. Now, maybe she does need to get another job, but should she decide to do that, I hope it's out of a wise reflection and not because she was proliferating based on a hair clip. Can we rest the attention in those simple encounters, those initial experiences, without letting the proliferations that happen emotionally and mentally circle around? All those entanglements of opinion, entanglements of view, all the stories that we weave. Can we just rest in our experience and trust that the simplicity of experience will permit insight to arise? Do we look to our experience for insight, or are we looking outside of us to teachers, to books? Just look into your own experience moment by moment, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, feeling, sensing. What else can we notice anyway? And what else could we possibly experience insight through? Simply sense the quality, this incredible capacity that you have for present awareness, a natural open knowing of things as they're actually occurring, this flow of life, this flow of changing experience. We don't need to look outside of us for fancy insights. We don't expect fireworks and rainbows. and auras to occur in our meditation. And we may end a retreat without even having any good story to tell about it. We might not even have a huge heart opening or a cathartic experience. Can our relationship to experience just be simple, clear, and undiluted? Relaxed, free of every trace of grasping. We look into our experience again and again, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking. That's all we get in life, really. And this is where transformation occurs. This is where insight occurs, in our moment-to-moment contact. We don't need to learn some special, esoteric, mystical, secret teaching. Although, maybe I'll give you a secret teaching now and then, but only on a walking interview. Not really. There's no secret teaching. The Buddha really was open-handed in his teaching. And our experience is plain as day if we just look at it. Anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Can we see this moment by moment so clearly that we cease to cling, that we stop this habitual distortion and attachment? Insight describes an immediate knowing that moves us beyond the fragmentation of the conceptualizing discursive mind. It's an order of knowing that is not limited to the intellect, that's not bound by ideas and concepts, and that very often simply cannot be adequately described by language, whether Hebrew or English or Pali. Yet insight has the power of releasing the tensions of grasping. It really does have the power to transform our relationship to things. And you feel that. I've heard you describe it in interviews, times when you just let go of something and you felt the heart open. And it was, you felt the release. You felt the ending of that strain of clinging. You felt the release of the burden of attachment. Now, sometimes you didn't quite totally let every tendency to cling go, so a little bit later you picked it up again. But you know the possibility of release, and you know the experience of letting go. We feel our life very intimately, very intensely. Can we be at ease and open and content with whatever we feel, whatever we find, so that we encounter this changing process of life that's in a way that the mind is unconfused and our relationship is unconflicted. We're profoundly at peace and okay with what's occurring. So as we meditate, we train ourselves to connect with the changing flow of moment-to-moment experience so that we develop the capacity to be deeply at peace with the fact of change, deeply at ease, even though what is happening is totally uncertain and uncontrollable. We sense an ease that comes that brings peace and gratitude, experiencing the wonder of the moment. When we stop trying to hold things that are changing, trying to collect things for our security and our happiness, our sense of identity, we discover we actually can remain open and balanced in the midst of changing experience. We don't have to grasp. We don't have to create a fixed identity. We don't have to make experience the basis for our happiness. We know instead a deep joy that comes through letting go and letting be. We're touched by this experience of not clinging. Traditionally, Clear seeing is understood as not perceiving the permanent contacts as permanent satisfactory in self. This clear seeing, this clear relationship to living, puts an end to clinging and reveals our freedom. So through meditation, we investigate whether or not we are clinging or whether we're free, whether or not we're holding something or whether we know that it's changing, whether we're distorting our experience or simply at ease with it. It's helpful to allow experience to be as it is. But so often we want our retreat to be a certain way. Maybe you decided before you came that this was going to be your experience, your retreat, where you had a deep insight into not self. And maybe it's turning out to be your dukkha retreat. Who knows? Maybe you came expecting to have bliss and happiness, and instead you're only getting calm and peace. Maybe you wanted calm and peace, and instead you're having an insight into anatta. You know, we don't always know what we're going to get. Maybe you wanted to work on a particular emotion or a particular issue in your life, and it's just not coming up. And so you have to go digging for it. Well, don't go digging. It's enough to see, hear, smell, taste, touch, and think with clarity. That's quite enough. Sometimes we're so identified with the events in our lives that we're personally traumatized by them and we think we have to fix them all. And sometimes we're just so entranced with the dramas of our identity that we recreate the story of self again and again. Sometimes we just aren't at ease with the flow of things. Some things are pleasant, some things are unpleasant. Sometimes there's gain, sometimes there's loss. Sometimes there's praise, sometimes there's blame. What is born will also die. There's another Mullah Nasruddin story I wanted to share with you. Oh, did I say it wrong?
No, you said it.
I said it with an American accent.
Yes.
Would you say it again with the Hebrew accent?
Mullah Nasr ad-Din.
Sounds almost the same. Oh, he was a Sufi, a rather wise Sufi,
crazy wisdom
master, fool, saint, who knows? A guy with good stories. And so Nasruddin, this story that I rather like is, he was good friends with the king, with the emir. And, the king was going, hunting for bears. And since he was friends with Mullah Nasruddin, he wanted Mullah to come along for company. And so he sent a minister to go fetch Nasruddin in order to invite him to come on this bear hunt. Now, Mullah Nasruddin was terrified of bears, but he could not say no to the king. And so he went along. And when he came back from the bear hunt, his neighbors asked him, how did the hunt go with the king? And Mullah Nasruddin said, marvelously. Oh, then they asked, how many bears did you kill? He said, none. And then, how many bears did you chase? None. And how many bears did you see? None. Then how could it go marvelously? And he said, when you're hunting bears, none is more than enough. We don't need to search out our bears in our meditation practice. We don't need to dig up a lot of personal stuff to work through and process in the silence. To know our freedom, we may not need to overcome dramatic challenges, and we may not need to sort out and figure out our relationship issues. But can we simply be as we are, with things as they are, as they're unfolding, moment by moment in our life, without resistance, without distortion? Freedom is as simple, as clear and present awareness. It's undistracted, the mind is at ease, and we know things as they are. Feel, listen, be aware of what's real now, here and now. Is anything really lacking in this moment? Even if this moment doesn't meet your personal expectations for a peak experience, this moment is just perfect as this moment. It couldn't be any way other than it is. So we open to what's real now, and we allow clear seeing to inform these simple contacts moment by moment in our lives, so that we live intimately with our existence rather than obscured in our vision. We know our experience of the senses vividly, cleanly, intimately, vibrantly, free of distortion, free of the distortions of concepts of I and mine. This is to be in touch with existence. This is to live intimately. This allows insight to actually transform our lives. We don't have to think about it a lot. Insight is not an intellectual process. We just live with the truth of things. We literally live with insight. I want to end with a verse by Kali Rinpoche and then have a few moments of silence. Kali Rinpoche was a great Tibetan teacher. We live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you are nothing, and being nothing, you are everything. That is all. We live in illusion and the appearance of things. There is a reality. We are that reality. When you understand this, you see that you are nothing, and being nothing, you are everything. That is all. Thank you.